You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Support comes from the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit, November 14th and 15th, convening hemp industry stakeholders to learn, connect, and grow. Details at pahempsummit.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni, I'm the host here, and we just went out to Cider Days in Franklin County in Western Mass, and I got to meet a lot of folks with a lot of standing and passion for the hard cider industry, and one of them joining with me today, Steve. I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, to say your name and where you work and everything.
I'm Steve Garwood. We have my daughter and I run a small cidery in West Brookfield, Massachusetts. We're located not too far from Amherst, a little bit east of Amherst, and we grow apples, make cider. I've been making cider for many years. I started drinking cider when I was a teenager. We used to have a cider mill here in our town, and farmers used to take their apples there. And when we worked on the dairy farms, the farmers would sometimes give us a drink of the cider that they had in their basement. So I have a lot of sense memory of old ciders fermented in whiskey barrels, and something that I try to bring to my ciders is that that feeling and those sense memories.
Wow. Well, let's go way back. So you've got a starting point. I remember it might have been 12, 13 years ago. A friend of mine owned the Blind Tiger Bar in New York, and every fall he was doing a Vermont weekend, and these kids at the time that were, now we know them as Fable Farm Cider, they were just basically pressing all the gathered apples from all the trees around them, and it was really tart, putting it in barrels. And it was the first time I had that kind of farm cider that had been made with the proper apples, really tart, but then aged for a year in the barrel. And I don't know if that's how they make the cider that they sell, but it really perked me up too. What is that any different from what we're getting now? You know, let's just reflect on how that those farmers used to make their cider and what you liked about it. How about that?
Well, this is an old New England tradition is to ferment the cider in whiskey barrels. Whiskey barrels were always available, even in the old days. They're available now, especially now that whiskey has gotten so popular, and bourbon whiskey, especially. The barrels are only allowed to be used once by the distiller for bourbon, and then when they're drained of their bourbon, the barrels get passed on. Very traditionally, they go to Scotland, and the Scotch makers age their Scotch whiskey in American oak barrels, American oak bourbon barrels. But even in the older days, pre-Prohibition days, these American oak barrels were available. The whiskey was taken from the barrels and bottled, and the distillers would discard the barrels. So they were cheap and plentiful, and that's what the farmers used to. If a farmer had a few trees, almost every farmstead had a few apple trees here and there, or maybe even just chance seedlings. But most farmers had a few apple trees that they cultivated. And the small towns like ours in Massachusetts usually had a local cider mill to press the apples. Everybody took a little bit of cider, a little bit of apple juice, either to drink fresh or to put in a barrel and just let it go, let it age. Whatever happens, let it happen. And as I say, that's the first cider that I had many years ago from a farm where I used to work.
You know, Steve, that's a great intro to what Cider Days at least felt like to me. This was my first time there, Cider Days in Franklin County, this past weekend. And there's that spirit of it, right? I know there's been sessions about apples, but can people go to an event like Cider Days and get juice that they can then ferment? Let's just talk about some of those kind of real hands-on experiences at Cider Days.
Well, yes. So some of the local orchards press apple juice especially to make available to cider enthusiasts who come to Cider Days. So they'll often have some different blends of apples that people can experiment with and make their own cider. And yes, that's always kind of been a part of Cider Days, is that people who are curious, maybe never made cider before, there was usually some workshops at the orchards that grow the apples. So you talked about foraged apples when you first started. There are a lot of wild apples in our area because of the Quabbin Reservoir. In the 1930s, Boston Area Water Commission built a big reservoir in central Massachusetts, and to build this reservoir, they abandoned five towns. And so there are a lot of abandoned farmsteads around in the central western Massachusetts area around this reservoir. And there's especially a guy named Matt Kaminsky, who has kind of made a career of going around to these abandoned farmsteads and looking for apples, both wild apples and also just old varieties that have just continued to grow in these farmsteads. So foraging for apples is kind of a Cider Days tradition also. And so and to explore some of these found apples and wild orchards, abandoned orchards and wild trees. And Matt and others bring these apples to Cider Days so that people can see them and try them and see how different they are from the apples that you get in the grocery store.
Yeah, no, that was really cool. I mean, I missed all of that, but I kept seeing the word pomological. I'm really glad we got to talk, Steve, because I saw you at Headwater Cider, one of our favorites, had a really nice event with several cider makers, and I got to taste through your whole line, which I don't think I've ever tasted everything you made before. Let's talk about that event and what it represented to you, because you said there used to be a bigger tasting events at Cider Days before the pandemic.
Yes. So the Cider Salon, as they called it, was one of the central features of Cider Days. It was usually on Saturday afternoon, and there would be, I don't know, at least 40 or 50 or more cideries represented there from all over the East, and everybody would bring their stuff, and people could taste as much as they want. There's a little bit of a problem with events that are that big that you can't taste everything. You just can't make it. you taste four or five or six cideries offerings and you're done. You know, they have to carry you out. But the event that where I saw you this weekend was nice. That there were basically, I think, four of us there, four cideries, and you could. You could taste through everything, and there were a lot of contrasts. Our approaches are different. There was cider of Spain was there with a number of different Spanish ciders, which go down a whole different world of taste profiles than our typical New England ciders. And certainly the ciders that I make. So you could get a lot of interesting contrasts. But this the event this weekend was nice because it was smaller. At the cider salon, where there are just hundreds of people and tens of cider makers, you don't get to have intimate conversations with people. So this weekend was very nice.
Yeah, the intimacy, that I think that's something that's very neat about it. It's not just like a big city festival. We got to go to a few places, including we went to West County, met some friends. We got to taste through several of the West County ciders, and they had an oyster shucker from Wellfleet, Mass. And then there was a great cider dinner on Saturday. I'm not going to recap the whole weekend, but I do want to highlight where I was. And this cider dinner was women cider makers, including your daughter Anne, and some other friends like Louisa from Farnham Hill and Eleanor from Eden. And that was organized by Rhea Windcaller of Cider Chat Podcast. And that was pretty neat. That's where I saw you and a few other folk, but. I just want to say that I got the flavor of Saturdays, and also being in that area, like Greenfield and those towns around it, and Shelburne Falls. And a big shout out to our friend Ron Sansone of Spoken Spy, who really was motivating me to go out this year. You know, you started out talking about the old farmers and the way they made cider in your area. I didn't even quite realize that the Connecticut River went through Massachusetts. How much does that area define what New England is, or New England cider? And let's say a little more about the region that we were in. This, like, is it central Massachusetts, western Mass? It's quite different than anywhere else I've been in the Northeast.
Yes, well, the Connecticut Valley is kind of has its own cultural economy and its own history, because it's a lot like the Hudson River. People could travel up the Connecticut River from the ocean all the way into central Vermont, and it's always been a center of industry and culture here in New England. The most of the apple growing and cider making occurs in the highlands that are on either side of the Connecticut Valley. Apples don't particularly like the really fertile soils of the Connecticut Valley. They're good for other things, and they're some of the most fertile soil in the world. But apples do like the uplands and the hills that where the elevation is higher, the temperatures are a little bit cooler, the soil is very gravelly and well drained, and so where we were. this weekend when we saw you, Jimmy, in Hawley, Massachusetts, it's very, very hilly. It's different than say Greenfield, which is, you know, down in the valley, Greenfield and Deerfield. Our cidery is actually on the east side of the highlands. So we're on the east side of the Connecticut Valley, and also in a very hilly area where we have our hilltop orchards, typically hilltop orchards, very well ventilated, breezy, well drained soil, and that's what apples really like.
Yeah, we started that day yesterday. It was Sunday. We started in Greenfield, so it must have been the valley, and we drove up to Peter Mitchell's headwaters. And once we got to his property, it was a totally different climate. There was a wind coming in and light rain, and it got chilly. When in the morning in the valley, I was wearing a shirt and a t-shirt.
Yes, it's its own microclimate, the uplands here. As I say, that's where you find most of the orchards in our area. It's also, you know, if you can draw a line that's about at the 42, 43 degrees of latitude, and it goes through our area, upstate New York, Michigan, Wisconsin, and on out through Washington State, and that's where you find the very best apple growing areas in North America.
Yeah, that's really great. You know, the book that came out, I'm sure many listeners know it, but not everyone does. It was, I think, a year and a half ago now. It was an American cider. Dan Pucci was one of the writers. That was the first time I really read about some few different regions. It was the first time it made me think more about New England as its own region. Let's talk about, so you grew up in that area. What were the first steps that you took with your property? And did you have any old cider trees on the property when you first went there? Or you're planting them now?
Well, there are old apple trees just about everywhere around here, our trees are intentionally planted. We do plant our older cider varieties. We've been planting those for the past 10 years or so. We especially like the Roxbury Russet apple, which is an apple that originated in Massachusetts, supposedly the first apple variety to actually be named in North America, comes from Roxbury near Boston. It's first written about or noted in the literature in the 1600s or early 1600s. It's a beautiful apple for cider. So these older apples, this was making good cider was one of the characteristics that farmers wanted in apples. So the best cider varieties are these old varieties that were particularly selected for making great cider. So we kind of try to specialize in the older cider varieties. Although I'll have to say, we do use one newer variety that wasn't developed in New England. It's a California apple called a Wixen. And the Wixen has a wonderful, pungent kind of flavor and makes terrific cider. We sold out of it. I didn't have any left for you to taste on Sunday, Jimmy, but I'd really like you to taste that.
Wixen. And I also noticed, just bouncing around, I noticed there were two different cider makers at that event that had a quince. I don't know if it was quince blend or quince based cider.
Yes. So there's a lot of interest in quince. Quince has some characteristics, a sharpness, almost a kind of a, I'm going to say gingery, sharpness, that makes an interesting cider. You can't use it just by itself, but blended with apple cider, it has some nice characters to it. Unfortunately, quince are really hard to grow. They're slow growing. They're susceptible to fire blight, like apples. And people are trying to grow it with some limited success here in New England.
Wow, it's interesting. You know, when you see the trends, that shows me that it's a thriving industry that people are trying. I had a Berkshire cider, and he had a really neat, it was called Community. It was a forage or community contributed foraged apple cider. And I want to talk about the different, not just styles of ciders, but by alcohol, by volume, because it seemed like even I always think of ciders as 6%, just as a benchmark. And what makes the ciders at the alcohol by volume? Kind of know about brewing beer, but you had a cider for 11%. You know, I've seen ciders for 8 and 9%. What's the difference in making it, but also is that just by design?
Well, yes. Yeah, so some people add sugar. You call it chaptalization. That's what they call it in the wine business, to try to soften up the idea that they're just adding some different ingredients in it. But adding stuff to cider, it kind of is a New England tradition. The farmers used to add raisins or brown sugar or molasses or what have you to their apple juice if they felt that the apples didn't have enough sugar to give them a good alcohol level. But what we've found with some of these old apple varieties, that they have a lot of sugar in them, up to 18 to 20% sugar if you let them stay on the tree. So typically an apple that you would buy at the store is maybe 11 or 12% sugar, and it might taste pretty sweet. So the amount of sugar that you have in an apple is what ends up making the alcohol. The sugar makes the alcohol. If you have an apple at 12% sugar, you're going to get about 6% of it in the alcohol. So it tends to be, as you say, sort of a benchmark. Most apples are around 12% sugar, but we find that some of these old varieties have, as I say, 18-20% sugar, so you can get up to 10-11% alcohol sometimes with them, and we like to do that. You get something that's very, very, very fragrant, very spirituous, and really gets in a different category of taste sensation than a cider at 5 or 6%.
Yeah, no, and I love cider. I've been lucky to at least have been around it since 2011, when the first New York Cider Week started. But yeah, I wanted to talk about your 11% cider, the Flora, because it was served at the cider dinner. We can also talk about pairings, because I feel like pairings for all types of beverages, food and drink pairings, kind of have fads, and they come and go. One fault of many of the basic ciders that people get is sometimes that alcohol level doesn't stand up to food. but you had an 11% floor. And let's just talk about that cider, kind of start to finish, just to give everyone a sense of what it is. Because when I had the dinner the other night, I thought, wow, this could fill what like a Chardonnay does, or you know, any other fuller body drink, and match up well with the grilled veal chop or smoked salmon or something.
Yes, well, one of my projects, or you know, something that I'm always thinking about in cider, is to how to get a nice big mouthfeel in ciders, and that flora. I mean, there's a place for a cider that is more milder, light, like a Prosecco. But the flora was an attempt to get at this, at a big mouthfeel, like not just like a white wine, but by like a white wine that has a lot of character to it, like a Vignier or you know, something that as you say, can really stand up to food and can give you a lot of pleasure in a lot of different situations. So the flora it's a blend of ciders. It's not just one apple. It's some of our traditional heirloom varieties, plus some ciders from our other apples, and it was aged for a while. In other words, we often don't just make it as fast as we can. We like to let it sit either in a barrel or a tank and mature and let the flavors mature is the best word for it. If a cider has a lot of flavor, a big mouth feel like wine, it. A good foundation of acid. It needs to sit for a while for everything to meld and mature, and it tends to soften a little bit. One of the great things about cider, as compared to wine, cider has malic acid in it. Wine has a little bit of malic acid, has a little bit of citric acid, has a little bit of tartaric acid. But apples are pure malic acid. And the malic acid is what gives cider its particular characters. And the malic acid tends to soften a little bit over time. It can be a little bit too sharp when the cider is first made. But if you give it some time, it mellows beautifully. So the flora is a cider that was made slowly, started off with even more flavor impact than it has now, but mellowed over time. I guess that's one of the ingredients. Time is an important ingredient in making a fine cider.
Now that's really a great intro. Thank you. Yeah, it's just about you have to. I think it's one more reason to say you have to go to events like the Cider Days or even our we have upcoming Cider Feast events. You really have to taste with the cider makers and really have the chance to experience it, because I think outside the box, you don't get most places. I don't think you really get a chance to taste real ciders. Also want to give a shout out before we take our break just for beer. When we were in Greenfield, Massachusetts, we ended up having lunch at the People's Pint, which I've heard of. And I knew that they were a supporter of local ag and local malts for a while. I had their basic IPA, which was really right on. It definitely wasn't too hoppy, but it had the right hops. It wasn't hazy. I really enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to going back to the People's Pint in Greenfield and trying more of their beer. So big shout out to them. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. Thank you.
Support comes from the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit. Join us for the Pennsylvania Hemp Summit trade show and reception at the Farm Show Complex in Harrisburg on November 14th and 15th. Connect with industry stakeholders and grow the industry together through our 2023 industry planning sessions, industry and legislature panel discussions, success story sharing, professional development workshops, and a research showcase. Register to attend or get involved by exhibiting or sponsoring. Details at pahempsummit.com.
Hey, hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Support us, become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. Well, I got to spend the weekend up in Western Massachusetts at Franklin County Cider Days. I've been heard about it for years, and then my friend Ron Sansone, a spoken spy, really encouraged me to go up this year. And Got to meet with Steve Garwood, who I've known for a couple of years, of Ragged Hill Cider in Westbrookfield, Massachusetts, and he's on with us. So we're starting to talk more about his ciders. We just talked about Flora, an 11% cider. You guys also you released a couple of new ciders at Cider Days. One of them was a Pet Nat. I think that those of us who like natural wine, you know, Pet Nat's definitely a trendy type of wine, but what's Pet Nat cider? And I mean, it sounds great to me.
So several of our ciders are what you would call Pet Nat or ancestral style, they say in France. The idea behind these ciders and wines is that they're put in the bottle before they completely finish their fermentation. And then they're put in a bottle, sealed up with a cap or a cork, and they finish their fermentation under seal, and that develops the bubbles in the cider. You can also... some people like to add some fresh juice or something that will produce a little bit more bubbles at that point. But the idea is that then some yeast remains in the bottle. Now, making champagne is a somewhat similar process, but with champagne, they do what's called disgorging the bottle. They actually get the yeast out of the bottle, and then you have a product that pours very clear and doesn't have any residual yeast in it. A Pet Nat is going to have yeast at the bottom of the bottle, so your first glass that you pour will be nice and clear, but then if you rock the bottle back and then pour it again, you're going to start getting a little bit of cloudiness, a little bit of yeast coming up from the bottom of the bottle. But that adds a whole other layer of flavor and can actually help to really bring out the fruitier flavors in a cider. So we do several Pet Nats. We do a Baldwin, a Wixen. The Flora is actually a Pet Nat also. It's very hard to control the amount of sugar that you have in the bottle when you make a Pet Nat. So you'll tend to find a lot of variation in the level of sparkle that's in the bottle. Sometimes it'll be a lot. Sometimes it won't be that much. The floor is very lightly pétillant, as the French say, whereas some of our other ciders have more bubbles in them. In beer, you would call it bottle conditioned. Same idea.
Yes.
So same idea. But
once again, you're talking about it's helping with the mouthfeel.
Yes.
And it takes a little more time too, doesn't it?
Yes, it takes time. So after you close it up, you're going to want to give it at the very least another 3 or 4 months to develop. The carbonation doesn't develop quickly in cider. At that point, it's a stressful environment for the yeast, and the cider doesn't have much nutrients left in it. And sometimes we even have to help it along, put a little bit more yeast, put a yeast starter into the cider at that point. But so at least another 3 months. I prefer 6 months. And actually, if it's a good cider, if you have a good structure to it, a good structure of acids and tannins, it's just going to improve in the bottle the longer it's in there.
Wow. Just back to the industry, you know, one thing I like about Saturdays also is there's a lot of industry people there, but they're talking about apples and they're giving away juice that people can make their own cider with, and they're tasting. I don't feel like it definitely feels like there's a lot of indie players, and that's something I like a lot about the hard cider scene.
Yes, I think that's very typical of our New England cider makers. A lot of us are very small. New England, farming in New England takes place on small hilly farms. We don't have a lot of huge open country where we have massive orchards. It's even different than New York State, where apples are grown on limestone soil. It's very flat. The limestone is well drained, but it's a different soil profile than we have in our hilltop orchards here in New England. So yeah, a lot of us are very small. We tend to, I believe that we're developing a typically New England style. Our ciders taste different than ciders that you see in the Pacific Northwest, let's say, or California. They're very different flavor profiles. It's because of the different varieties of apples, and it's because of the different temperatures that most of us cider makers aren't hugely sophisticated. We don't have big temperature controlled tanks. We're fermenting at ambient temperatures, and that makes a difference style wise. I'd love to do a tasting with some of my favorite California ciders versus our New England ciders, and really demonstrate to people the different taste profiles that we're getting. So we're gradually, as the cider industry is maturing, moving forward, we're starting to evolve some very definite regional styles.
That's really interesting, and that did stand out to me, that all the indies, and you know, it wasn't like a branded event. It was just cider makers. And I mean, at that dinner we went to on Wednesday night, in addition to the women cider makers, you said that there were experts there like John Bunker, and then I know that William Grote of New Salem Cider. They were all sitting at the tables around us. A woman, Ambrosia from the Northman Cider Bars in Chicago, was with us, and Chris Kazak's, the cider maker at Eden. it was really neat. You know, you don't get too many industries like that where you have the actual owners or cider makers dining with everyone else. So that there's a special feeling to it. I want to get to your Pommeau too, because I you know, let's say I tasted from your dry to through your Baldwin, the Pet Nat, and the 11% Flora. I keep calling 11% Flora because I do like it that much. But then there's the Pommeau, and I did buy a bottle and took it home with me. Tell us about Pommeau. I mean, I know it because I'll say in 2009 when I was before I got into cider, there was a Pommeau from France named Domaine DuPont. And through one of my beer importers, I always had some. We actually would use it as a goodbye drink. We would keep a cask of it on the bar and give taste to good customers as they left. How did it go from getting Pommeau from France to having Pommeau from the Connecticut Valley in Massachusetts? And how do you make it?
Well, I've always loved French ciders. And I have often looked to French styles and French methods for making some of my ciders. And Pommeau is something that they make in France nobody really makes it anywhere else. There's not really an English tradition of a drink like that, or a German tradition or a Spanish tradition, just thinking of some of the other big cider producing areas. The idea of Pommeau is, at its simplest, it's apple juice preserved in apple brandy. It's a blend of fresh apple juice, preferably from cider apples, which means apples that have a little bit of bitterness, some tannins, some structured taste to it. So apple juice that's made out of these apples. And then most in France, most cider makers make Calvados, or make what's called Calvados in France. It's apple brandy. Most cider in France is just something that's on the way to becoming brandy.
So the base.
Yeah, it's the base for brandy. So virtually everybody who makes cider makes brandy, makes Calvados, and Calvados is really the bigger product in France. So Calvados, apple brandy, it's distilled cider, and we have a local distiller here, Jerry Friedman at Beaver Pond Distillery. He distills our cider, and we every fall we take some of our apple juice from our heirloom apples and blend it with the apple brandy that Jerry makes for us, and we put it in a bourbon barrel and age it for another 18 months to 2 years in a bourbon barrel. So you get a drink that has wonderful multiple layers of flavor from the fresh juice and from the apple brandy, which itself has been aged for a couple of years in an oak barrel. You get the layers of the oak from the bourbon barrel, which is a highly charred American barrel, and that charring of the American oak, which has it's sweeter than French oak, and it has a more caramel kind of flavor to it. So the Pommeau has layers of flavor that sometimes remind me of chocolate, even of dark chocolate and caramel. And but over it all, you get a layer of acidity also. So it's a wonderful thing. It's a natural outgrowth of of cider making. And it's funny, when we first started making it, when I first started talking to Jerry about it, Jerry at Beaver Pond, I said, I'm going to make this pomo. It's going to be a couple of years before it's ready, but I think it's going to be terrific. Jerry just said, how's it? Nobody knows about pomo. Nobody's ever going to buy that. Well, what are you going to do with it? I said, well, I don't know. It's just, it's what I want to do. It's what I want to make. So it's turned out to be very popular. The pomo that you have, Jimmy, is the, I think that's the third year that we've come out with it. It's always very popular. We always sell out. I think it's becoming almost sort of another typical New England thing. And our New England pomo is different than the French pomo. We make it. I'm going to digress slightly here, but
is great. How is it different? Because I didn't know that.
Yeah. So us New England cider makers, a number of us make ice cider, which is something we haven't talked about yet. But have you had our ice cider, Jimmy?
I have, and we've done shows about different ice ciders. I've had Headwaters ice cider, yours, Eleanor at Eden's, of course, and a couple of New York ones.
Yes. So
yeah,
we make ice cider here in New England.
That's the showpiece one, right?
Yeah.
It's something everyone loves, and people kind of get it right away.
Yes. Yes. So those of us who make pomo style drink in New England, we usually put a little bit of ice cider into it, and it actually sweetens and thickens it up, makes it a little bit more unctuous than the French pomo, and I think it ends up being something even a little bit different. And you know, we really shouldn't call it pomo. I think it's different enough that we should have a different name for it. And after all, the French, that's what the French call it, pomo. It's a name like champagne or like Calvados. It's not really fair for us to just steal that name. I think the name of pomo is what we now call pomo is going to change over the next few years. I think here in New England, we're going to have our own terminology for it, and our own way of making it.
Well, thanks for the insight, because I'll keep following it, and which means I'll keep having to drink it.
Yeah.
So we won't call it pomo. We'll call it, what do we call it, harvest something.
Well, we've got when we get together with the people you mentioned, Eleanor and Peter and other people, Jonathan Carr, those of us who make pomo and make ice cider, we're kicking around a bunch of names. And even with as you mentioned, Ambrosia, Borowski. We're looking for a name. We're looking for another name.
Well, that's great. We'll probably leave it at that and just let people think about it, because could do a name competition. That would be fun. I guess it takes. I guess after a while too, it's hard to explain to people what pomo is, and if yours is slightly different, that's good. One last thing. You know, I don't want to get too into goals. I'm glad you like kind of said more about the indies and the small farms of New England. I didn't want to go to Fire Blight, but you did talk about it before the show. What's the challenge for the growers of New England? And I want to give a shout out to Benjamin Watson, who would have been on the show, but he has an internet issue where he is in the country. So we would have talked more about growing apples, but I'm glad we got to talk with Steve Garwood of Ragged Hill Cider in West Brookfield, Massachusetts. So Fireblight, just a quick 101. What's Fireblight, Steve, and why is it a problem for you guys?
Well, Fireblight is it's a terrible disease. Apple trees are susceptible to it. Also, quince trees and other kinds of trees that are related. It didn't used to be such a problem, but it's becoming a problem with the changing climate here in New England. It's a problem as the spring weather is becoming warmer. Without getting too deep into the weeds, fire blight, it's a bacteria, and it attacks the tree when the blossoms are open and when there's warm, wet weather while the blossoms are open in the tree, and it gets into the tissues of the tree through the open blossom. So what's happening in New England is that the weather is becoming warmer and wetter at the time that the trees are blooming. And that's causing fire blight to be on the increase. So there's an added problem with the apples that we like, those of us who make fine cider. They tend to be late blooming. They're late harvesting and they're late blooming. They're the apples that we harvest in late October or early November, and they bloom later than your regular eating apples like Macintosh and Honeycrisp. So the fire blight conditions are even worse when these apples are blooming. So it's becoming a problem, especially for cider makers, and the fire blight is moving northwards with the warming climate, and it's just a big problem.
So it's not easy.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you, Steve, for taking the time with me. I just wanted to give a little spotlight of what does happen at Franklin County Cider Days in Massachusetts, why it's so great, all the great independent producers and cider makers and enthusiasts that are there. One shout out there's a, we talk about English knowing their cider. At the dinner table with me on Saturday night, there was a man who was born in England and had always had a taste for good ciders. He'd been going to the Cider Days event for over 11 years. So it's pretty neat that it brings so many people together in the way that it did. And I'm going to leave it at that because we have many more shows to do about cider and events and cider feasts and all that. But Steve, thank you so much for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our engineer, Armin Spengen. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.